So, you know, the journey of this film, I think, needs a little bit of a shout out from obviously from Sundance. When we met in Oxford, it went, it ended up in Dallas, where we also saw you again there. But it's basically traveled the country, Atlanta, Cleveland. It's gone all the way through the South, all the way to the West Coast. I mean, it was at San Francisco International, Bentonville. Obviously Hot Docs in Toronto, and you just came back even from Australia, if I'm not mistaken, or it just was in Australia.
Yeah, we were actually in Amsterdam at ITPA, and the film was also screened internationally at Hot Docs in Toronto. So as you mentioned, we screened the film all over the U.S., at festivals and with our theatrical release, and it was really wonderful. Sundance was just an amazing experience, and it was really great to bring the film shortly afterwards to my home state, to the Oxford Film Festival.
I've got to ask, the importance of when you did the Sundance documentary edit and story lab a few years prior, how did that help get this film kind of focused, I guess, would be the answer to the question.
Yeah, when I did the Edit Story Lab, I believe it was in 2017, I was at a point where I had been working with an editor on the project for about a year and a half, and just realized that I needed to transition on the kind of Mac down creatively. It's wonderful, but we were at the point where I knew I needed to work on the structure of the film in a way that we hadn't been able to before, and wasn't sure what my next move was in terms of who to work with, and also didn't really have the funding, so I was kind of in this a bit of a limbo around the edit, and was spending some time just trying to figure that out when I got a call from Sundance, inviting me to attend the lab, which was really quite remarkable. It was the first time that they had opened the lab up to filmmakers who weren't their grantees. And I was also the first filmmaker to go without an editor to the lab, which was, you know, it was my first lesson in trusting the folks like Tabitha Jackson and Kristen Feely and Enrique Pedrada, who encouraged me to come anyway without an editor, and turned out to be really the most beneficial thing, because we had five mentors who were all really pretty incredible and wonderful. But because I was there without an editor, they really spent a lot of extra time with me thinking through story and looking through my footage. And you think at an edit story lab, too, the other surprise was that we did very little editing. It wasn't until the last few days that we started to do editing, but what was really helpful was excavating all of the story elements that I hadn't had time to spend thinking about for, in a few years. It's been 10 years working on the film, and so there were elements that I thought about in year one that by the time we got to, which was about 2010, by the time we got to 2017, I hadn't thought about before. And so some of those elements were the readings that Danny Glover does of lynching documentation. I had always envisioned that, and we had cut a sample, but wasn't sure how to use that. And those are the kind of things, in addition to just how to use the footage that I have more cinematically in the edit. There's footage that I assumed was thrown away that I realized was really valuable for helping people to have an immersive experience of the story that I was trying to tell. And so in a lot of ways, the lab was really incredible. And then being able to work with mentors like Bill Ross, who has been an advisor on the project and has been really supportive since, and Carol Dysinger, whose film was just nominated for an Oscar, and Rob Moss and Yancey Ford and other folks, has just been a real gift.
That's so amazing. And so grateful that the Danny Glover segment was in there. I mean, his voice is so powerful. The way he delivers the information, it's haunting.
It is, and it was, you know, just the timbre of his voice is pretty extraordinary. And I also thought it was really important because of all the activist work that he does around issues of racial justice, and so it's a great match.
So I've got to ask you, you obviously talked about being able to bring it home to Oxford, but varying and different responses that you've been able to witness and see going to so many different places around the country and now around the world. How have you felt about people's reaction? I mean, this film is it's one of those documentaries that hits you long after and sticks with you. But for you personally, have you been pleased with the amount of support that's come from the festivals and from the people who've been able to witness this?
I have, and it's good to hear that that's your take, because that's in the edit, that's the thing that we wanted, is for audiences to immediately, even before they leave their seats, is to start to process and talk about and discuss the film and the issues, and to have those images and the things that they see in the people that we feature in the film have them reverberate in their lives long after. It was really our goal. We've had I looked at the festivals, and we did so many festivals, about 60 or so in 2019, and I'm heading to a festival tomorrow, the Cinema Matters Festival in New York and D.C. So we're continuing to screen the film in festivals, and then we distributed the film, self-distributed theatrically, in about 15 cities around the country. And so there have been well over 100 screenings of the film, and I see each of those opportunities as the time that I can take with the audience during the Q&As and the panel discussions to really have the dialogues that are needed about lynching and about related issues of structural racism, and all of those conversations that are challenging, and that, you know, people's response is that they are moved by the film. Some people are really overwhelmed by the information. It is brand new to a lot of people, the details of lynching, and are just really horrified by the extent of the brutality, the scope of the violence. But they are often grateful for being able to have a conversation in the Q&As for the first time on issues of racism and issues of racial violence, historic and current. And there's a good percentage of the audience, I would say about 40%, who will tell me either during the Q&As or after that they've had a family member who was lynched and rarely got, if ever, got to talk about it, or that they had a family member who attended a lynching or organized a lynching. And so because the violence was so prevalent in all of the country, which is why certainly the South was it's a region that we were really focused on, but we wanted to get the film out widely so that we can have the kind of conversations that are needed around the issues.
Obviously, Lennon's...
There are exciting things that pop up for me that are really unexpected. So we have that kind of response in Q&As where people are watching the film, but I was just at a speed dating event in the Bay Area, and, you know, I was thinking about dating and reintroducing myself to people in the room, but there was a woman in the room who said that she had heard me talk about the film on an interview like months before that, when I started to tell her about the work that I do, and that interview was really crucial in her deciding to go to Palestine to do work there around the issues that are going on between Israel and Palestine, and that she was really afraid and really reluctant to go, but that the courage that I talked about the folks in the film, like Claudia, to really confront what's happened with her son and to call for justice and to confront these issues despite the resistance, really inspired her to go ahead and schedule the trip. And so it's those kind of surprises that I've been getting that pop up over the past year that have really been moving for me and really special for me.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. That's really amazing. I've got to ask, you know, obviously Claudia's way of trying to keep her son's legacy is so important to the film's power. But one of the elements of the film that shocked me maybe even more so was the reenactments that happened in Georgia. Can you talk about coming across that information and what were your initial feelings when you found out about that? I mean, that is a fascinating look into the history of it. That I don't think people could even imagine is happening today.
Yeah, I spent 2 years researching and developing the project, and when I found that there were people on the ground, like the ordinary folks with often no acting experience at all, who are working to tell the stories about what happened to the two couples who were lynched on the Moorsport Bridge in 1948, the Malthams, the Dorseys, to tell their stories so that the nation remembers via dramatizing those events in the spot where they happened. You can see the lynching unfold through the reenactive efforts right on the Moorsport Bridge where the Malthams and the Dorseys were killed. I was so moved by that as an organic expression of the community to tell the story in the way that they know it, and also in with details that would not have been documented in most cases with lynching, when reporters showed up, when medical examiners and morticians showed up with the bodies and on the scene, that there was a lot of information lost because they had no incentive to tell the details of the violence that often authorities and ordinary folks participated in their communities. And so it took me a minute when I heard about the reenactment to wrap my head around what a lynching reenactment could mean. And then I started to parallel it to Civil War reenactments and thought about the fact that that is about telling and defining a narrative that's really important, that people want to transcend time and to have for future generations, in addition to memorializing the victims. And so similarly, that's what people on the ground in Monroe, Georgia, and Atlanta are doing.
Can you give us an update on Claudia and anyone else in the film? You can give us an update from, like, when I saw in Oxford to obviously right now in 2020.
Sure. So Claudia, the wonderful thing about Sundance is it was the first time to share the film with the folks that I had been filming with over the years. And so it was a really beautiful thing to bring about 17 or 19 of our crew and cast members together to share this stage for panel discussions. And we had 7 screenings over the weekend, almost all of them. I think all but one sold out before the festival began. And so to be able to share the film with Claudia and Pierre, we did a private screening with them ahead of time because I didn't want them to process their emotions in front of for the first time publicly. And so that they were so moved by the film and that they felt like it accurately represented their journey, but also who Lennon was, and was really a wonderful thing. And it meant that every other review I could be okay with them. And so Claudia has continued to go to screenings with us over the past year and to participate in panel discussions. And each time she sees the film, and she feels like it is hard to watch, but it's really important to be present with it. And that the beautiful thing is that it tells the truth about what has gone on around that case. And she is still looking for answers to what happened to Lennon. The FBI, which I'm sure you know, ruled in 2016 that there wasn't enough evidence to pursue a homicide investigation. So that's all very open-ended. But Claudia is still, nevertheless, looking for answers.
With that being in mind, I'd love to hear you respond to not only Lennon's case being given that terrible way of closing a case, but that being sadly the many cases prior to that similarly being given that treatment by FBI and police organizations, do you feel that there is any possibility of seeing change in the the FBI's eyes, the police eyes for the future, that these cases are there's too many of them to be considered the way they're considering them, or they have been considering them? I mean, do you feel that your film can help change the viewpoint of that?
You're right. Yeah, historically, less than 1% of the cases of lynching ever went to trial for murder, right? And it's the cases you see as police shootings and vigilante killings are being videotaped and the FBI has taken up those cases, that there has been very little recourse. And so I'm a natural optimist, and so I would say that it is certainly possible. And for for them to change systemically. I think it requires that we and all of us really do the work that's needed to push the institutions to change the way that they approach cases like this. For me, it's always been about whether Lennon committed suicide or whether he was lynched. It's always been about, for me, the fact that Claudia and his family deserved, they had the right for the local investigators to approach the case in a way that respects and acknowledges this history of lynching and racial violence and what's going on currently in the community around racial division. And so, that's the kind of thing that we can work on to push institutions to be able to look at these cases and investigate them appropriately. And then there's work that we can do for repair for each other. There are things that we can do in our own communities for family members of folks who are victimized, who have been victimized by lynching, and people who are victims of other forms of racial violence. And it's really very much what I am hoping that the film inspires in audiences, that we start to look at these issues and look at what we can do for each other in our communities and to think about it with imagination. Reparations is certainly about financial restitution. That's hugely important. But there are other ways, other things that we can do. And like the reenactors in Monroe, we decided to carry out a lynching reenactment over the years.
I've got to ask, since you've traveled so much with this film, and there's still hopes of traveling more, I know next month you're going to be busy like crazy as well. As far as the longevity of this story, is there a point where you feel that you can release it, or do you feel that you'll always be carrying this mantle or, you know, with this movie? I mean, this must be a very difficult film to even attempt to step back from, just because it's so pertinent, it's so important, and obviously it's something that I think you realize how massive it is to get this voice heard.
Sure, it's always been my goal. It's actually the reason why I made the film is to be able to get it out to audiences, to have the conversations that are needed around these issues and in specific cases like Lennon's death. And so what we're planning to do, I have a team of folks and we're working on impact and engagement screenings in which we have deep dialogue in conversations in which we are centering on family members of victims in communities around the country to really look at what repair looks like. And so those will include workshops on reparations and healers in the room to help people to deal with the trauma of this in the moment, but also to offer tools that they can take back to their communities, in addition to resources from organizations that we're partnering with, like the ACLU and the Vera Institute, Auburn Seminary, and others, so that people, as they're having these dialogues and start to have them more and more in their communities, that they're building coalitions to do the work that's needed. So all of that has really been a priority for me. But I'm continuing to do that. I'm really excited that we're planning that, particularly around our PBS broadcast on Independent Lens on February 24th. Our first our team's impact efforts will start in February. That's always been a driving force for me, and I'm happy to do that. Once you finish a film, as a filmmaker, you know that as soon as you're finished and you release it, it is out into the world, and it's the audience's film. And it's a really a beautiful thing, actually. So I can create a scene with a certain intention, and every person who comes to this scene comes with a different lens and can interpret that scene very specific to their own personal stories, and that's also a beautiful thing.
Jacqueline, you mentioned in an interview, I think in a couple of interviews, in fact, the impact that Shoah had on you, that film series and
yes,
those interviews. Can you talk a little bit about how that helped scope this movie? I mean, I think those films obviously share a real connection to what you've done here with Always in Season.
Yeah, absolutely. Shoah is a film that I probably came to in the 1980s that is about the genocide, the Holocaust that happened. And the director interwove dozens of interviews, and it's a 9-hour film, which is really quite extraordinary. And I am such a lover of films and documentary in particular that 9 hours is an easy watch for me. But I loved the way that the director interwove the interviews with people who had survived the Holocaust, so that those interviews echoed the details in a way that they confirmed each other's story, but also showed very clearly the scope of the horror that happened during the Holocaust. And so it's those kind of films, including the films of directors like Stanley Nelson, who's a mentor of mine, and who Firelight Media is his production company and was one of the funders of Always in Season. It's watching the way that other really incredible and brilliant editors have approached their work that's really helped me to think about Always in Season, which I've always wanted to show the scope of the terrorism. I could have focused just on the reenactment and made a quirky story about something that's very unique that's going on there, or I could have just focused on Claudia Lacey and Lennon's case and told that story. But it's been really important for me from the very beginning, as I was researching this history and understanding just about the point where I started to think, oh, I really understand the level of horror and brutality that's happening, or that happened historically, I would come across another case that was that much worse. And so I was really clear about how much it's impacted this country and wanted to mirror that in the approach to structure with Always in Season. And the wonderful thing is I got to work with Don Bernier, who is our lead editor and who I hired coming out of the Sundance Edit Story Lab. And we really worked to craft the narrative out of about 1,000 hours of footage that did just that, that showed comprehensively what's gone on, but in a way that is cinematic and that's also very concise. And so to take those 1,000 hours of footage and bring them down to a 90-minute story was by far my biggest challenge, and ultimately it was a really wonderful experience and a creative height for me to be able to figure out the structure of the narrative with Don and other folks on our team.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you for having the courage to stick with that dream of making this a bigger film than just one story. I know in the 3 times I've seen this film, I take a different element from it each time, and I can't wait to see the national broadcast and see something new and different. But thank you. And thank you for the time once again. And I hope this film just keeps going on and on. I think you're opening eyes and changing minds. So thank you.
I appreciate it, Gotti. Thanks for the interview.
You have a good day. Thank you.
Bye.